mean I'm looking to die on that hill, but it means about human beings that you're talking about. It is not intuited by people who are monsters, because they wouldn't. There's no hill they'll die on because they don't believe that deeply in things. They're about something much more mundane. So that's good news for us, because that means that there are a lot of people who, if we can reach them, will join us and will be courageous about it. The problem is it's an arms race, because even those of us who will look at a particular hill and say, you know what, that one's important enough, right? Even those of us who will do that, there are things that frighten us, right? This is why torture has returned to the West, right? The West swore off torture. It understood it to be fundamentally wrong, right? It's actually written into the American Constitution that it is wrong. But the West has returned to torture because it provides a tool. If your toolkit is inadequate to control people, because there are too many people who will die on that hill to prevent you from doing it, then you have to innovate fates worse than death, right? And there are fates worse than death. So we are in an arms race, my friend, and the enemy has no decency. So
no.
This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. You're listening to Brett Weinstein speak with Neil Oliver after the recent A Better Way conference in Bath, England. On June 25th in New York City, there will be the Minds Festival of Ideas at the Beacon Theater. Go to minds.com to buy virtual tickets or in-person attendance tickets. This conversation runs another 30 minutes in length. Now back to the conversation.
I wonder if they've got the... I've thought this before, that the terrible things that were done, the horrible and unforgivable of the 20th century, was perpetrated and then committed by generations who had seen and done terrible things. You know, the survivors of the First World War then became active in the Second World War, and then you get into the second half of the 20th century, in which all sorts of the gulags and all the rest of the, you know, the horrible was a progression, but it was being done by people who had been to some extent brutalized, or some generations that had been brutalized. It takes quite a lot of doing to commit the horrible if you've lived in a world of essential peace. I have my doubts that those who seem to be running the show now have the bottle to commit to set themselves to the necessary wet work that you're describing.
That is a new thought to me, and it's a beautiful one, and it also rings a bit true. I hope you're right.
I don't think they've got it in them, because they are not. They like the rest of us in the West, have mostly grown up in a time of peace, and they haven't seen and done that which had been seen and done by previous generations that unknowingly brutalized, either stood silent while other things were done or actively participated in them. There aren't any people who are the product of that alive at the moment. And I don't think they've got it in them to do what would have to be done when enough people... The last time the horrible was committed, there were only 1.5 to 2 billion people on the planet. There's now 8.
Yeah.
That's a big lump of butchered meat. If you decided that you were going to get stuck into it, I don't think they've got it in them. I think when push comes to shove, they'll back off because they haven't got it in them.
Well, they won't back off, but I like your model here. It rings true. What I think we have seen already is that, just as your model predicts, they will be capable of the most spectacular indifference to human suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But that's different than what you're calling the wet work. Right? The willingness to demonize a drug that would help people who are dying alone in hospitals because their family is forbidden to enter, right? The callousness of that is jaw-dropping, but it's not the same thing as ushering somebody into a gas chamber.
No. No, that is my point. Oh, that's my hope.
Yeah. No, I like it. I'm going to be thinking about that for a good long time and comparing it to everything I know and that I see and trying to figure out, you know, how thick that ice is. Because, A, if it's true, it actually tells us something about the beast that we're fighting that's useful, that's actually operationalizable. And I hope you're right. And frankly, I hope if they're listening, that they understand what's being discussed, because whether they know it or not, they're depending on us succeeding, right? Their mechanism for governing this planet is absolutely reckless, and there is no way that the planet can survive it, right? They are not good at managing complex systems. And that's one thing when you don't have extremely powerful tools, and so your errors are limited in their scope, but the tools are getting more powerful, right? This is not going to be a long ride if you don't get some very careful thinkers into those roles. So, you know, to the extent that these people who are behaving so monstrously, have children and grandchildren that they want to deliver a world to, they ought to wake up and figure out, you know, who it is that they would trust this place to, because they can't do it.
Agreed.
So there are a couple, I think when I started this conversation, I was so eager to talk to you about substance that I didn't say much about who you are and what you do. And this is worth adding in here. I know now that you trained as an archaeologist. I know that, is it your first book, is The Wisdom of the Ancients?
Well, that's not my, your first I've book. Got about, I think, well, I've lost count now. Ten books out there with my name on them, yes.
Yes, all right. Well, that's a lot of reading that I have to do, but, all right. So, and you have a current book, a new book.
I do. I have, a book called, The Story of the World in 100 Moments. I'm a generalist. You described yourself. You said an evolutionary biologist with a generalist. I'm a generalist of another thought, of another sort. I've always just loved the storytelling of history. I'm not a historian. I am an archaeologist, but it's the stories. It's the tales of daring do. It's the aspiration. It's the triumph and disaster of it. I love the kind of round the campfire recounting of great deeds. And that I try to emulate that in sort of books that are, so they're light. It's light history, I suppose. I've produced a book called The Story of the World in 100 Moments. And it's not a textbook. It's not supposed to teach people the history of the world. It's maybe to encourage people to think about what they think are the most significant moments spread across the 4 or 5,000 years of recorded history. The things that, each one of us is an individual and a different set of lights come on for each of us. If you looked up at the night sky and you hadn't understood the constellations as they've been perceived, we would all make our own patterns out of the night sky. And so I'm suggesting that history is all the lights in the universe. Now, what patterns do you make? What does your eye give you when you look up at that confusing spectacle of light? And so some of it, you know, there are events in the story of the world in 100 moments that are maybe things that people would expect, and others are tiny moments that just resonate for me. But it's always been about the storytelling for me. I enjoy another fantasy that I had for the book. I had long thought, wouldn't it be great if as a party trick, you could stand up and in 10 minutes, tell the story of the world. If you could distill all of it down into something meaningful that could be recited. Memorized, what a great trick that would be. And so the book's partly a product of that. I'm fascinated by the way in which certain stories have lasted for thousands of years. Why? You know, we've still got the Epic of Gilgamesh. It's still with us. We've still got the stories of the Old Testament. They're still there. And you think, well, they've come down to the present day because they are the distillation of wisdom. And they've become shorter. They've been compressed out of the great heap of coal has been compressed diamonds. And you have to ask yourself, why are we still telling ourselves some of these very old stories? Well, in part, the answer is because they're true or they have truth in them. And I love that. I love stories.
So I call this metaphorical truth. And my definition is metaphorically true things are things that you are at advantage if you believe them as if they are true rather than recognize that they are not exactly true. And I also say you cannot write a myth, right? You can write a story and then evolution will either favor it, alter it, distill it, and turn it into a durable myth, or it won't. But the point is, you can't write it that way. It's selection that does that, right? It's the great stories that get refined in this way. I must say, though, there's a, you know, it's characteristic of you to be so modest about it. But when you say, well, it's not a textbook, you know, it's light, you're describing the craft of delivering this very potent thing in a way that it doesn't feel like medicine, right? And so I esteem this at the highest level. This is what somebody who is truly good at conveying something deep will do, is they will deliver it in a way that you don't even realize you're transformed by it, right? And so anyway, I'm looking forward to reading this book.
I love the way that as well that I'm quietly obsessed with, for example, say the cave art from 30,000 years ago, Lascaux, Altamira, and so on, because there must be a storytelling in that as well. That the creation of those tableaux of animals, who knows, they will have served many functions, but there must have been a storytelling aspect within it, and that they are still have the power to move us in our 21st century world. I mean, I defy anyone to look at some of that cave art and not have the hackles rise. There's something, you know, Picasso said after Altamira, all is decadence, acknowledging that something had been achieved then by those shadows, those lost people, that has never been bettered, not by Michelangelo, not by him, not by Leonardo. There's something so potent and that those people 30,000 years ago in worlds unimaginably different from ours, in circumstances, living day to day in circumstances that we cannot conceive of, they still set aside time for that kind of creation. They crawled into the darkness, deep underground, with little lamps in their hand, little animal fat and tallow lamps, and found these contours on rock that suggested to them that there was something there that ought to be brought to the surface. Like sculptors say that the thing is already in the rock and it just has to be released. They were looking at the contours of the rock illuminated by shadowy light. And then like someone fly fishing, you know, they were trying to lure the bear or lure the bison to come further forward out of the rock. And when they glimpsed it, they just put a line on it. There's its shoulder. There's the flank. And that's enough. We've done it. And they will withdraw. And they walked away, and the darkness fell on it maybe forever. That those people living those lives at that time set aside some of their, every fire had to be kindled, every morsel of food had to be found or hunted, and yet they were still making time to do these extraordinary things deep underground in the dark. And we are still moved by them now because what they did was true and it mattered and we can feel it.
All right. At the risk of being the scientist who can't help himself but to pull apart the flower, I want to take a look at what you've just described from a slightly different angle. Imagine for a second that you have a compulsion. If I know that ancestors made the effort that you've described, which is not a small effort, to leave these renderings on these cave walls, right? I know they did it for a reason, and that reason has to be something other. It has to improve their well-being, their fitness in some way. And I think what it is, my hypothesis for this would be that these pictures transport information through time, vital information. And I can imagine, if you have effectively hunter-gatherers who are nomadic, who are following creatures that are huntable, right, that you would imagine that a population would ebb and flow into a valley, and it might be generations between contacts with a particular location, right? Imagine that your ancestors left you a treasure map in a cave so that when you arrived in this valley, you had some idea what the passage of the seasons would bring, right? What is this place? Is it okay or is it not okay, right? That kind of information, right? And then this actually really is the same thing as what we call art, right? Because what art does is it takes things that we need to know, and I don't necessarily mean that analytically, but things that we need to know. You know, Guernica, it can sit dormant on the wall and you can marvel at the, you know, the insight of Picasso and the strange mind that he had to be able to convey this thing with those odd shapes, right? But then at some point, somebody starts dropping fucking bombs on somebody else and it's like, Guernica, got it, right? That reminder from somebody who saw something, who figured out a way to transport it across time to you, even though they wouldn't be there to explain it, right? That's a really important process, right? Orwell is back, right? That's important. Now, here's the thing, though. Let's go. That cave, right? One interpretation is that the message on that cave wall is no longer relevant because we are not hunter-gatherers, and so the populations of huntable beasts are irrelevant to us. Okay, true. On the other hand, imagine that this creature distantly related to us, not so distantly, but distantly in our time scale, was telling us something about what we are, and that it is again relevant, right? Because we have come so far from that, and yet, as you point out, it's the basic human characteristics that are still going to make the difference.
Yes, I agree with all of that. I marvel at our modern response to something that comes from another world. It enables us to reach through 30,000 years and momentarily have a moment of connection with people that shuffled over the hill into the invisible eons ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing that they left behind still affects us. You know, that we're still running hunter software. Although we live these sophisticated lives, we are at heart the animal that we've always been. And a glance at the artwork of Lasko reminds us that we are the same. And we know we're the same because we look at those pictures created by them then, and we are moved by them. Whatever they mean, whatever was the motivation for creating those works, it moves us. And I think you're right, we definitely have. I think part of what has been exploited, is being exploited this very moment by those who don't have our best interests at heart, to put it mildly, have lost connection with humanity. They've lost that sense of awe. You know, we insulate ourselves from pain. We insulate ourselves from dying and death. We put it out of sight. We don't involve ourselves with it. We don't want to see it. We don't want to smell it. We don't want to be confronted by it. And we are the less because of that. There's a growing distance from the flesh and blood of humanity. And we must reclaim it. We must remind ourselves of it. And looking back at for example, at those ancient works, I think is helpful and it's therapeutic, because just to be reminded of what a wonder the human animal is must never be forgotten. And part of what is being done now is being done by people who have forgotten how special we are. This thirsting, lusting towards artificial intelligence and transhumanism and all the rest of it. Hold on. You know, before you do all that, let's remember just what we are, what we've been capable of, what we're still capable of. And then we'll treat each other with more dignity and more decency.
So there's a problem with our design, which is it is built around a practical scope. In other words, your perception and your cognition were built in an ancient environment in which there was no point in thinking beyond yourself past a certain threshold because there was nothing you could do about it. And so from the point of view of enhancing your fitness, keeping an eye on a couple of generations out was about the most that was worth doing. And any effort you spent thinking about the distant future was wasted, for example, because you didn't have any power or influence over it. That's not true anymore. And in some sense, what I'm getting from your description is 30,000 years ago, creatures stood in a cave and invested in something that reaches us now and reaches us in an important way. It's not trivial. And A, imagine what you would have to do that anything that you left behind on Earth was meaningful to anyone 30,000 years in the future. Almost impossible to imagine what you could do that would meet that challenge. Also likely, there will be no one here in 30,000 years, right? We'll be lucky to get through the next 200. So that should be alarming to us, right? Relatives from 30,000 years ago did something that's meaningful to us today, and we can already see that our time horizon doesn't extend that far into the future. Alarm bells should be going off, but we're not built to register them because we have this narrow scope about only a generation or two ahead. And this ought to be recalibrating that sense about what's important, because in some sense, think about all the people who will never be. If we cease to exist in the next couple hundred years or 1,000 years, all the people who will never get to experience this, who might otherwise have, what right is it of ours to deny that to them? Aren't we obligated to deliver it?
Oh, yes. I mean, the Mervyn Peake line about to live at all is miracle enough. I've had a growing sense that we are lacking a sense of awe. I think that's the best way I can describe it. We're not awestruck by each other. And we should be. And we're almost embarrassed about it. And we live in these pixelated, digitized worlds where we look at each other through screens. So there's literally a distance between us. And it's becoming easier and easier to live like that. You could live inside your house on your own, have everything delivered to your door and communicate with people, but you're not really communicating with people. What I got from being in that conference hall yesterday was fundamental, because it was being in a room with hundreds of fellow human beings. And there's nothing quite like it. When you say something on the stage, you know instantly if it's registered or if it's had any effect on even one person or on the collective. It's an amazing feeling. And if we forget how important, how energizing and enriching it is just to be in a room with people in the analog and not the digital, we need to reclaim a sense of awe.
We do. And, you know, this is one of the real perks of my line of work, because it does allow you to see, if you do it right, that the miracles are literally everywhere. You and I at this moment are engaged in an utterly miraculous process, right? I am literally vibrating air molecules in order to put a thought in your head. And I can have reasonable confidence that if I do that well, you will actually have an idea that bears resemblance to the one that I meant to throw at you at this distance, right?
Yes.
That's a miracle. In the windowsill, there might be a housefly. Have you ever looked at a housefly? Even that housefly is a miracle, right? You know, let alone a hummingbird or something even more marvelous. They're everywhere. And, you know, you're right. I like your focus. And I agree with you that in that grand sea of miracles, human beings are the most remarkable product of the universe that we know. It's the most remarkable one that we've seen. All right. Neil, would you like to wrap us up? Because I think we are
out of time. How do I do that?
Well, I don't know. You tell us what we need to know, and then we will revisit this at some future point.
I wish that the last 2 years had not happened. In the events that have unfolded, I wish it were different. But here we are. But I also value the experience beyond price. And I'm aware that by saying this, it begins to sound ridiculous. But it only doesn't sound ridiculous if you've gone through the process. Having obviously been sleepwalking and being blissfully unaware for I don't know how long about the true texture of our reality, and having been snapped into a sudden awareness of it, having suddenly seen it all as though from a different perspective or a different bit of high ground, I feel I have added to the store of my wisdom something that is beyond price. So while in so many ways I wish that this hadn't happened, it having happened has made me a better person. That's really all I can say. I would rather be the person that I am now than the person that I was before. And the collateral benefit is it has brought me into contact with people like you and others that were in that room. And I value that some accident, some unexpected sequence of events has brought me into contact with those people. And so I'm glad that that's happened. And I think I'm beginning to understand what I now understand.
I agree. It's been transcendent. And I must say the beauty of being able to sit with somebody that I will just confess I find utterly delightful. And I know that that is a widely shared belief because I heard 25 people say it at this conference in separate contexts who weren't talking to each other. We love you and keep fighting.
Well, that means more to me than I can say, Brett.
All right. Well, this has been a pleasure.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. You have been listening to a conversation between Brett Weinstein and Neil Oliver, following the recent A Better Way conference in Bath, England, recorded on June 2nd, 2022. Brett Weinstein has a podcast called The Dark Horse Podcast with his wife Heather Hying. There is an upcoming conference in New York City, June 25th at the Beacon Theater, one night only. It's called the Minds Festival of Ideas. Minds.com is the sponsor, M-I-N-D-S. And you can buy tickets to attend online or in person. Some of the guests include Tulsi Gabbard, Dr. Cornel West, Zubi, Majid Nawaz, and more. One of the topics is how to navigate media manipulation. Another one is satire and disinformation. Where's the line? Again, that's the Minds.com Festival of Ideas on June 25th in New York City. You can buy virtual or in-person tickets. This program runs every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. this summer. You can find archives at WMFO.org, and I think it's recorded there, so for a week or two. Coming up next for the last half hour of the program, I just want to play a couple of clearly psychotic and pathologically deviant clips from this person named Yuval Noah Harari, Yuval Noah Harari. He is a lead advisor to Klaus Schwab, who is the author of the COVID-19 Great Reset Agenda book and the founder of the World Economic Forum. This guy, Yuval, is praised by Klaus Schwab, Barack Obama, Mark Zuckerberg, and Bill Gates. And as we hear him for the next 2 to 6 minutes, you'll hear just real anti-humanist, psychologically manipulative in tone, and somebody who hates everybody else. Now, this particular tone that he's using is called the it's not called anything specific, but it makes you believe that something is already occurring. He is creating a psychological manipulation with the tone of voice and the presence tense of the verbs to make it seem like this type of scenario that he's talking about is unavoidable and ultimately will come down no matter what you do about it. That's incorrect. That's a con. That's a scam. This guy is a psychopath and a scam con artist, and you must listen to this with that in mind. This guy, again, is Yuval Noah Hariri. Sorry. Yuval Noah Harari, a background psycho in a time of stress, who is creating more stress for humanity.
COVID is critical because this is what convinces people to accept, to legitimize total biometric surveillance. If we want to stop this epidemic, we need not just to monitor people, we need to monitor what's happening under their skin.
What we have seen so far, it's corporations and governments collecting data about where we go, who we meet, what movies we watch. The next phase is the surveillance going under our skin. We're now seeing mass surveillance systems established even in democratic countries, which previously rejected them. And we also see a change in the nature of surveillance. Previously, surveillance was mainly above the skin. Now it's going under the skin. Governments want to know not just where we go or who we meet. Above all, they want to know what is happening under our skin. What's our body temperature? What's our blood pressure? What is our medical condition?
Now humans are developing even bigger powers than ever before. We are really acquiring divine powers of creation and destruction. We are really upgrading humans into gods. We are acquiring, for instance, the power to re-engineer life.
I know that in recent years, we saw populist politicians undermining deliberately the trust that people have in important institutions like universities, like respectable media outlets. These populist politicians told people that, say, scientists are this small elite, disconnected from the real people.
I mean, all this story about Jesus rising from the dead and being the Son of God, this is fake news.
Humans are now hackable animals. You know, the whole idea that humans have, you know, this, they have this soul or spirit and they have free will and nobody knows what's happening inside me. So whatever I choose, whether in the election or whether in the supermarket, this is my free will, that's over.
Clearly the voice of a monster. A psychopath. A useless human indeed. Now, in a biological organism like a human body, if you get a cancer that's going to slowly grow and take over the body and destroy that body, what do you do with the cancer? You cut it out, you remove it. Now what about this guy, Yuval Noah Harari, H-A-R-A-R-I? He's the lead advisor to Klaus Schwab, who is the author of the COVID-19 Great Reset book and the agenda to turn every person into a controlled apparatus of the state. What do we do with this guy, Yuval? I mean, I can't, if I express my true, you know, gut level human reaction about this guy, I'm no better than this guy. What can be done about somebody who is clearly a danger to humanity on a large scale? Let's hear more from this monster.
The biggest question, maybe in economics and politics of the coming decades, will be what to do with all these useless people. The problem is more boredom, and what to do with them, and how will they find some sense of meaning in life when they are basically meaningless, worthless. My best guess at present is a combination of drugs and computer games as a solution for more. It's already happening, under different titles, different headings, you see more and more people spending more and more time or solving their inner problems with drugs and computer games, both legal drugs and illegal drugs. You look at Japan today, and Japan is maybe 20 years ahead of the world in everything, and you see all these new social phenomenon of people having relationships with virtual spouses, and you have people who never leave the house and just live through computers. I think once you're superfluous, you don't have power. Again, we are used to the age of the masses of the 19th and 20th century, where you saw all these successful, massive uprisings, revolutions, revolts. So we are used to thinking about the masses as powerful. But this is basically a 19th century, a 20th century phenomenon. I don't think that the masses, even if they somehow organize themselves, stand much of a chance. We are not in Russia of 1917 or in 19th century Europe. What we are talking about now is like a second industrial revolution, but the product this time will not be textiles or machines or vehicles or even weapons. The product this time will be humans themselves. We are basically learning to produce bodies and minds. Bodies and minds are going to be, I think, the two main products of the next wave of all these changes. That is optional. Again, and if you think about it from the viewpoint of the poor, it looks terrible.
Because why? Because they're useless and don't contribute to society, so they will have to be removed? Is that why? Yuval Noah Harari? What a complete psychopath, devoid of conscious... devoid of conscience and attempting to manipulate the world to a psychopathic future. We just can't say enough bad things about this guy. What a freak of nature. And the thing is, he's an advisor to Klaus Schwab, who runs the World Economic Forum. That was created by Henry Kissinger back in the early 70s, because Klaus Schwab was seen to be the progenitor of the worst parts of Kissinger's nature. So the World Economic Forum is only the newest, most visible section of the urge to control humanity in a technocratic landscape using technology to track you, surveil you constantly, tell you what to do, and make sure you don't live too long. Well, like I said, what do you do with a cancer? You get rid of it. But how can you do that in a modern society? Where are you going to go? Fiji? They've still got the internet there, and it's pretty nice. The reason I played these clips for you is so that you can understand that there exist monsters out there with an imagination on the scale of the greatest passionate artists and scientists in history. These are monsters to the deepest, darkest levels of the psyche, and their self-hatred and hatred for the world runs to the core, and they have been able to be enabled and held up by powerful interests who share some of the same agendas that they do. These agendas exist, and evil does exist in the world, and it is not alone. It is continually evolving and being fed by new people as the old people teach them and die. So, how are you going to defeat it? Well, do you defeat it or do you just work around it and have a better solution? It's like Brett Weinstein said in that talk, it's an arms race. One interesting thing I just saw on the Academy of Ideas YouTube channel is the idea of a parallel society. It's called The Parallel Society versus Totalitarianism, How to Create a Free World. This video is 12 minutes long, and again, it is from the Academy of Ideas YouTube channel.
This content is made possible by individuals like you. Become a supporting member and access our growing library of membership courses and videos. Learn more at academyofideas.com/members. The real question is whether the brighter future is always so distant. What if it has been here for a long time already, and only our own blindness and weakness have prevented us from seeing it around us and within us, and kept us from developing it? Across the globe, a confluence of factors is destabilizing the fabric of society. Many government institutions are corrupt to the core. Many politicians are so detached from reality that they view those who want freedom as enemies. The legacy media has morphed into the propaganda arm of the government. Instead of seeking the truth, the function of these institutions is to augment state power and demonize those who dissent. To make matters worse, global economies have been ravaged by destructive government policies, and while rampant money printing has created a mirage of economic stability, this mirage is quickly giving way to an ugly reality. Politicians tell us that if we are unhappy with the way we are ruled, then we can express our displeasure at the polls or even run for office. But this is to assume that the democratic ideal is the best way to return freedom to an unfree world. This is to overlook the corrupting influence of state power. This is to forget that the massive bureaucratic class that operates many of the levers of government is not replaced through elections. And finally, this is to assume that state power is the solution to what ails society. Perhaps state power is the poison that is destroying it. A more practical solution to what ails the modern world may be to allow the dead weight of the state to collapse in on itself, as it inevitably will, and to soften the blow of this collapse through the creation of a parallel society. In this video, we are going to explore what a parallel society is, how it played a pivotal role in the fall of communism in Eastern Europe, and how the creation of a parallel society may be our best chance of returning freedom to an authoritarian world. If it proves impossible legally to compel the ruling power to change the ways it governs us, and if for various reasons those who reject this power cannot or do not wish to overthrow it by force, then the creation of an independent or alternative or parallel society is the only dignified solution. The basis for the parallel society was born in the mind of Ivan Jirus, a Czech poet and the artistic director of the rock band The Plastic People of the Universe. After members of this band were arrested in 1976 for refusing to toe the government line, Jirus called on the community of Czech artists to create music labels, publishing houses, concert halls, art expositions, and other such infrastructure that existed independently of mainstream society and outside the grasp of the communist state. Jirus hypothesized that if enough infrastructure were created, an independent society would spontaneously form and function as a pocket of creative freedom in a highly oppressed society. Jirus defined the independent society as a society not dependent on official channels of communications or on the hierarchy of values of the establishment, and as he further explained, the independent society does not compete for power. Its aim is not to replace the powers that be with power of another kind, but rather under this power, or beside it, to create structures that respect other laws, and in which the voice of the ruling power is heard only as an insignificant echo from a world that is organized in an entirely different way. Jirus's idea caught the attention of the Czech Catholic philosopher and mathematician Václav Benda. Benda saw in this idea the seeds of a non-violent solution to the destructiveness of communism. However, for the independent society to have real-world social and political impact, it needed to be extended beyond the realm of music and the arts. For the stifling bureaucracy and heavy hand of the communist government was suffocating all areas of life. And so Benda coined the phrase parallel society to refer to all social, cultural, and economic structures that existed unconstrained by the state. He called such structures parallel structures. And at the height of political oppression in the late 1970s, Benda urged Czech citizens to begin creating parallel forms of education and science and scholarship, parallel political structures, a parallel information network, and free parallel markets that form a parallel economy. And as H. Gordon Skilling explains, outlining the parallel structures which had come into existence or might do so in the future, Benda argued that these might gradually supplant or at least humanize the existing official structures. The rationale behind the creation of parallel structures in the parallel society was simple. As the communist government had a monopoly on force and was too powerful to challenge head-on, it was best to turn away from it and defy it by ignoring it as much as possible. Rather than trying to eliminate oppressive state structures, it was better to build up better ones that could function as alternatives or replacements to the establishment system that was in the process of dying. A well-known communist dissident, Yasik Kuron, captured this rationale in 1980 when he responded to the torching of a communist headquarters by stating, "Stop burning down committees, let us build our own." Or as Ivan Yerus explained, "The parallel society began in spontaneous acts of mutual self-defense in different parts of society. Those who take part are active people who can no longer stand to look passively at the general decay, rigidity, bureaucracy, and suffocation of every living idea or sign of movement in the official sphere. And because these people sooner or later recognize that efforts to bring about the slightest improvements in the official sphere were exercises in futility, it was only a matter of time before they said, why not invest our talents, abilities, goodwill, and enthusiasm into something that no one will be able to corrupt, that we will be able to decide about ourselves in the end? The parallel society provided individuals the means to express themselves freely without fear of censorship and to fulfill their goals and aims without being suffocated by the bureaucracy of the state. Furthermore, individuals felt that by turning towards parallel structures and away from the establishment structures that functioned as vehicles of the state, they were influencing society for the better. The parallel society thus served as a much-needed source of hope in a society which had succumbed to apathy due to decades of communist rule. And in the latter half of the 1970s and throughout the 1980s, this hope inspired people throughout all of Eastern Europe, and the parallel society infiltrated many areas of culture and the economy. Even my most audacious expectations have been considerably surpassed, wrote Benda in 1988. It is no longer necessary to show that the parallel society is possible. By the late 1980s, the parallel society in Eastern Europe had become so strong, decentralized, and decoupled from the state that the communist authorities lost their grip on power. The revolution which swept through Eastern Europe in the closing months of 1989 was a spontaneous product of the massive discontent and the yearning for freedom of the peoples of those countries. It was also a culmination of the independent activities of many citizens as they sought to defend their rights against the party-state system and to create a parallel or independent society as a challenge and an alternative to it. One of the more famous examples of a parallel structure was the underground film industry in Romania. The communist dictator Nicolae Ceausescu outlawed the possession and distribution of Western films. However, the entrepreneur Teodor Zamfir created a vast underground market smuggling Western films into the country and then translating and dubbing them into Romanian. The demand for the films rapidly grew, and as the Romanian people were exposed to Western culture, their eyes were opened to the full extent of their own oppression. As one Romanian dissident put it, the seeds of freedom that were planted by the films grew. Zamfir made a fortune off this parallel market and he became one of the most powerful men in Romania. And in an interview for a 2015 documentary, Zamfir explained, "During the 1989 revolution, everybody was in the streets because they all knew there was a better life out there. How? From films." Given advances in technology and the capacity to spread information, goods, and services across the world, the potential to create a wide variety of parallel structures on both a local and global level is significantly greater today than it was in communist Eastern Europe. And so rather than passively waiting for a political savior to bring us freedom and save us from societal collapse, a more realistic strategy is to actively participate in the construction of a parallel society. We must create all kinds of independent parallel structures, that is, structures unmanipulated by totalitarian power. Contributing to the creation of a parallel society could amount to, among many possibilities, consuming independent media instead of legacy media, using alternative mediums of exchange rather than government-backed fiat currencies, using social media platforms and decentralized digital infrastructures that promote freedom of expression, or supporting local businesses rather than global corporations that further the agenda of the political establishment. It could amount to creating self-sustainable communities, conducting scientific inquiry or scholarship free of institutional pressures, or consuming and creating educational resources, art, music, or literature that pays no heed to the establishment status quo. Any action or enterprise that expands the realm of freedom while creatively circumventing censorship and top-down authoritarian or totalitarian control is a boon to the parallel society. For as Egon Bundy, one of the leading figures of the Czech underground, explained, "When the activity of those who oppose the establishment becomes articulated, it will be in forms, methods, and ideas that are totally unknown, incomprehensible, and unacceptable to members of the establishment, and that is how it should be." Once a parallel society is sufficiently established, a society is no longer under the same grave danger as when it relies solely on the structures and institutions that are appendages of the tyrannical state. For if these establishment structures collapse, parallel structures will soften the blow of an economic or social breakdown. Furthermore, parallel structures cater to the authentic needs and wants of the people rather than the political class, and so they tend to be more life-promoting than the establishment structures. As parallel structures develop and solidify, more and more people will instinctively turn towards them, and as the parallel society expands, so too does the sphere of cultural, economic, and political freedom. A genuine parallel society would, by a process of metastasis, penetrate all the important social structures. And as Václav Havel further explains, "The ultimate phase of this process is the situation in which the official structures simply begin withering away and dying off, to be replaced by new structures that have evolved from below and are put together in a fundamentally different way." In 1988, a year before communism in Eastern Europe collapsed, Ivan Jurus reflected on the growth of the parallel society and on the dramatic social changes that were following in the wake. "The parallel society has proven its worth," he wrote, "and it is the only meaningful structure that people can create if they do not wish to remain mere appendices of the political and social structures created by the ruling power." Learn more about our membership, access transcripts, and the art we use in the videos by visiting academyofideas.com.
You have been listening to The Parallel Society versus Totalitarianism, How to Create a Free World, from the Academy of Ideas channel on YouTube. The Minds.com Festival of Ideas is happening in New York City on June 25th at the Beacon Theater. You can buy tickets to attend in person or online as on the live stream. If you go to Minds.com and find the Festival of Ideas. That's MINDS.com. And the Festival of Ideas is at the Beacon Theater in New York City on June 25th. One of the guests that day will be Majid Nawaz, in addition to Dr. Cornel West, Tulsi Gabbard, Tim Poole, and Zuby, and many others. Majid Nawaz is someone I've been listening to. He's got a great Twitter account. His name is MAAJIDNAWAZ. And also Glenn Greenwald provides something not spun in a fashion that is going in a certain direction. He has a relatively unscathed viewpoint. I think the term of art is captured. Glenn Greenwald is not a captured reporter. This show runs every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. on 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. The opinions expressed do not necessarily reflect those of the station management, Tufts University administration, or the Board of Trustees. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you again next week.
Doing what I'm doing, they give me all kinds of warnings, save me from ruin. When I
I say that I'm okay, well, they look at me kind of strange. But surely you're not happy now, you no longer play the game. Ah, people say I'm lazy, dreaming my life away. Well, they give me all kinds of advice, designed to enlighten me. Tell them that I'm doing fine, watching the shadows on the wall. Oh, don't you miss the big time, boy, you're no longer on the ball. I'm just sitting here making the wheels go round and round, and rock the Boston road. No longer riding on the merry-go-round. I just have to let it go. People asking questions, lost in confusion. Well, I tell them there's no problem, only solution. Well, they shake their heads and they look at me as if I've lost my mind. I tell them there's no hurry, I'm just sitting here doing time. I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round. I really love to watch them roll. No longer riding on the merry-go-round, I just have to let it go. I just have to let it go.
Smart, living in this time, it's not so easy to carry on. So if you are my friend, treat me like a friend, a friend in need, and a friend indeed. But just in case you